The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Connect with ultra-fast speeds and our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, Iceland's best-selling author Ragnar Jonasson told me how he went from translating Agatha Christie novels into Icelandic at the age of 17 to penning his Hidden Iceland series of thrillers. Rachel Scanlon spoke to me about IVF and the long and difficult road travelled by herself and her partner Kevin in the hope of having children. Paddy Burke got in touch to tell me about the kindness shown to him and his family after his son Patrick was diagnosed with leukemia, and to remind people why it's so important to reach out and help each other. And 2FM presenter Kira King talked to me about Children in Hospital Ireland's Cup of Kindness fundraising appeal and her personal connection to this important cause. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy. I have never been to Iceland. I have never seen a documentary on Iceland. But for whatever reason, about 6 months, maybe 8 months ago, just as COVID kicked in, I was delighted to pick up a copy of a book by Ragnar Jonasson. And now at 9:29 this Monday morning, it is a pleasure to welcome the author of those wonderful books to the show from Iceland. Ragnar, good morning to you. Nice to meet you.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Tell us a bit about where you are this morning and what you're looking at in terms of Iceland. And what is it bright? I'm kind of almost fascinated by light, darkness, snow, sun, all of it.
So I'm in Reykjavik, and I'm sitting in my office here looking out the window, and it's getting bright gradually. But this time of year, the mornings get darker quite rapidly, day by day. Mm. And so we are entering the darkest time of the year, of course. But it was snowing this weekend, so there is a little bit of snow on the ground, which makes it all much easier.
Okay, good news. The series of books that you've written, and we're going to talk about the third part of the Hidden Iceland series, The Mist, was released in paperback earlier this month. That's the trilogy that kind of got me interested in your books. There's a few places I want to go with you, Ragnar, for me. One is just the reason I ask you about the geography and the meteorological conditions in Iceland is because they are essentially a character in each and every one of your books.
Yes, I think it's safe to say. I mean, the Icelandic landscape and the nature we have here is so quite remarkable and still so difficult to live with, of course, as well. But I don't think you can really write fiction set in Iceland without taking that into account or just embracing it in a way.
Because you can sense a lot of it is, I think claustrophobia is a word that comes up a lot because it's intense, whether it's a lot of darkness or indeed too much light. But when it's snowing, it just seems to be relentless.
It is, yeah. And especially in the north where some of my books take place, I mean, you can get a lot of snow. And some of these locations, these small villages, they're all on the coastline. And some of them are so isolated that it's really hard to imagine. And I really like, you know, wondering what impact that has on people and try to put yourself in their shoes and, you know, imagining what's it like to spend a winter in a faraway place maybe as far away from Reykjavik as you can get and you know, with having a hard time getting away, basically.
I think that, you know, Iceland and Ireland, there's only a letter between us in some regards, and it's as islands go, you don't have massive population where you are. It's there's fair few similarities between the two. They're well placed to be settings for crime novels.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you have the better weather, I guess. But
that's the first time someone's ever said that to me. But yes.
But otherwise, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of history, you know, between Iceland and Ireland, and from the you know, ever going back to the Viking Age as well.
Your relationship with Agatha Christie is very important, I think, to your story, Ragnar. Can you take us back to your 17-year-old self?
Oh, absolutely, I can. I was 17 when I had this idea that I could translate a whole Agatha Christie novel. And I'd been reading those books for years, and they were publishing one book every year before Christmas, like people do here, because we have this thing called the Christmas book flood. And I just went to the, or actually my mother drove me to the publisher of Agatha Christie in Iceland, because I was too young to drive even. And I suggested to him, you know, could I translate the book for you next Christmas? And he just looked at me like I was a bit strange.
Yes.
But then he gave me a call back a few days later and said, you know, go ahead, try and translate a book and just pick anyone you can choose, and I looked at my shelves of Agatha Christie books and I picked the thinnest volume I could find, because I had no idea how long it would take to translate a whole book. But I did it, and that was the start of a collaboration. I mean, for, you know, 15 years, I think. I did one Agatha Christie every year while I was in school and in law school, and even when I'd started working. I only stopped when I started writing my own books.
Your own books then would lend themselves a little to the Agatha Christie tradition, but not in every sense, but just really like a good crime book, as yours are so good. The idea of a selection of characters, a crime is committed, sometimes in a locked-in situation, and whether it's by snow or by building, what have you, and it can only be one. I mean, is that fair to say that tradition followed you along from your teenage days?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I still read Agatha Christie. I still love her, and I love the golden age of crime fiction. And what I try to do is, I mean, I try and use what I loved about Agatha Christie's books and sort of put that into my own novels in a way. I mean, as you mentioned, the isolation, and the settings. She used the settings quite well. And then she had these fantastic plots and plot twists, of course. And that's what I try and do as well. I mean, to have some sort of a twist at the end. But of course, my books are written in Iceland in a different era. So I think they're, you know, in a way, Nordic noir at the same time, I hope.
Oh, no question about it. But not unlike Agatha Christie. Agatha Christie's books, people kind of go, oh, sure, like it's Hercule Poirot, and they're kind of cute and Sunday afternoon television. But actually, the books are much darker in reality. And you're the hidden Iceland, the darkness, the island, and the mist. The chief protagonist in this is Hulda, and she's 64 in the first book. She's 50, and then her life you chronologically change it back to 40. But a very deeply troubled story, unraveled bit by bit in each book. That's an unusual for somebody like you, for, you know, with your background as a young man, to alight on a woman in her 60s as your chief protagonist.
Yeah, it took me some time to start on that series. I mean, I had written like 5 books before about a young man, a young policeman, and I think I needed that time, I needed that experience to basically tackle Hulda. And then I felt I was ready to write about something that was a bit less familiar to me, obviously. And but as you say, I mean, it is, I think, quite dark in a way. And this trilogy is not only just a series of crime investigations. It is the story of Hulda, the story of this woman, actually told backward, as you mentioned, but. But that was what was most interesting to me, was just to tell the story of a woman in the police force and her struggles from just basically from birth to the end. And I mean, I wrote down on a piece of paper a few years ago before I started writing these novels an outline. I said to my publisher in Iceland, I said, this is the woman I want to write about. This is her life story. And I think it will be 3 books. And he said, yeah, go ahead. And that's how Hulda came about.
Okay. And the quintet before, which I've finished the 4th one this weekend, Ari Thor, another beautiful series. And I noticed in the theme, you just mentioned a minute ago, Ragnar, that this gorgeous tradition in Iceland about the Christmas Eve book, which I think, as I was reading it going, this will be perfect for Ireland and Irish people. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is one of my favorite things of the year in Iceland. So every year, the Icelandic books by Icelandic authors are usually, most of them are published from October to December. and in hardback, and these are looked upon as Christmas presents, and people give books for Christmas. I think it's safe to say more or less everyone in Iceland gets a book, or one or more, for Christmas. And the tradition is that you open your presents on Christmas Eve after dinner, and then once you've sort of done that, people just sit down and read into the night. They read a new book, usually a new hardback Icelandic novel, and just, sit by candlelight, eat their chocolates, and just read, and hopefully finish the book into the morning of Christmas morning. And I think it's a beautiful tradition, and I absolutely think this should be adopted into countries as well.
It sounds dreamlike in its simplicity, and that's where we suppose we need to be. One other thing I wanted to ask you about was the presence, almost like a character in so many of your books, of the economic crash in Iceland. Because I remember when the crash was happening we were feeling the effects here, there was a lot of focus on Iceland, and it clearly has scarred your country in a way that was profound.
Yes, it is impossible to write about Iceland, in the last decade or so without mentioning this, because this was the sort of overwhelming catastrophe of the decade, and it did impact everyone, but we were able to move ahead, and I think sort of in the past 3, 4, 5 years, things have turned around drastically, and what we have to thank for that actually is the tourism. The Icelandic currency sort of just crashed and made Iceland a cheaper destination, and then we had this tourism boom, which is on hold, of course, at the moment. But I think just travel and tourism has brought us back from the crash, and things are getting back.
Well, as soon as
normal
the,
in Iceland.
Exactly. As soon as the COVID thing sorts itself out, I'll be on the first plane over to Iceland. I'm fascinated. So I look forward to getting over there, maybe saying hello to you in real life soon, Ragnar. Thank you for your time today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I look forward to it. Mind yourself, and thanks for your time. Congratulations on it all, and thanks for all the lovely pleasure you've given me with your books in recent months.
Thank you. It's so nice to hear. Thank you so much.
Not at all. Ragnar Jonasson joining us from Reykjavik in Iceland this morning. And honestly, if you like the noir thing, this comes with the highest recommended. There's the trilogy, which I just mentioned there. That's The Mist. That's the third one out. And they're all in paperback now, so they're easy to get. But you probably have to dig up a little further with your local bookshop for the Quintet, which, as I say, is a beautiful series of books that are, they're just haunting and engaging and thrilling in many ways. I want to say good morning to Rachel Scanlon. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Ryan. How are you?
Thank you for joining us this morning.
No problem. Good to be here.
Yeah, you were, what, 35 years old, I think, when, for the purpose of our story, your life started to change. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, it would.
Tell us a bit about yourself up until that point.
So I suppose I was living my life. I enjoyed my life. Anybody who knows me would know I enjoyed a drink or two and a good party or two.
Yeah.
And
sounds normal to me.
Yeah. And I was single up until I was 34 and I met Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
And I had traveled and I had lived in Chicago for a few years and I traveled to Australia and life was good. I enjoyed my life. Everything was good.
A life well lived to that point.
Yes,
good.
Absolutely.
Good.
Absolutely.
What happened?
So I met Kevin. We knew fairly soon on that he was the one. And we started trying to have children.
Mm-hmm.
And quite soon on, I had a positive pregnancy test and thought to myself, this was great, couldn't believe it, it was amazing. But that was just the beginning of our really, really long journey, when that pregnancy test turned from positive to negative within 24 hours.
That's swift, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Mm. And that was a chemical pregnancy, which basically means your egg fertilizes with the sperm, but it doesn't implant into your uterus.
Mm-hmm.
And so the test can change really quickly.
And that was in 2009?
That was in 2009.
Which was a pretty horrible year for Kevin, essentially, and then for both of you as a result.
Yes, it was. Kevin lost his younger brother, and then a few months later, he lost his mom. So, yeah, that was a really, really difficult year. And I suppose for us, you know, we just kind of went on the back burner. You know, it just wasn't the main focus.
Of course. But it came back into focus ultimately. And, you know, one of the positive things about a more modern Ireland is that we can talk about things like miscarriages in a frank way. And I don't mean that in a cold way, by the way, or in an emotional way, because it's just a desperately difficult situation to have to face into. But you faced into it more than once.
Yeah, we did, Ryan. Like we had a lot of miscarriages and a lot of early miscarriages and a lot of later miscarriages. But yes, we had a lot. And so we sought treatment. I went to a GP to kind of explain my story. And with that GP, and I suppose this is also kind of probably Ireland, but I explained that we were trying for a baby, and she immediately looked at my wedding finger, and I just thought, because we weren't married, you know, and I just thought, you know, I just want to go to a GP that's a bit more progressive.
So you found one?
So I found one, and she referred me to a great doctor from New Zealand. And he really helped me through. I was with him for years, and he really kind of started me on the road to IVF.
Right, and this was not just any old road to IVF. Yeah, I've never heard of anything quite like your story. So, what I'm going to ask you to do is do me a favor for people out there who really don't know what the IVF process is, because I think physically and emotionally, it is not an easy road to travel. So could you give me a step-by-step, obviously without going into absolutely every scintilla of detail, but a rough guide, if you like, to be crude about it, to how this works?
So, yeah, it's a long old process. So it depends on, different women have different experiences, obviously, and different clinics treat everybody, obviously, very differently.
Sure.
Everybody's body is different, but there's different protocols that you can go on. And what I found myself on more than once was a protocol where you down-regulate, which is your body is kind of suppressed into a menopause-like state.
Mm.
And I suppose it's to allow the clinic to take over and to take over the regulation of your body. And so then you stop producing eggs so that the drugs can take over and produce the eggs for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're suppressed into kind of a menopause state, and you start, and that probably lasts for a couple of weeks. And then you start injecting yourself with hormones to produce follicles that will eventually produce eggs. And so you're injecting yourself every evening. Sometimes more than once a day, twice a day sometimes. And that produces follicles then. And you're scanned on a regular basis through that period to make sure that you're not overstimulated, so you're not producing too many follicles, or that you're not understimulated, so that you're not producing enough. So you're scanned at all times.
Are there side effects, Rachel? Or?
There are. Like, you're pumping your body full of hormones.
Of course,
so your moods are up and down. You're all over the place. My other half sitting beside me laughing here.
he's nodding. I remember that. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you're hard to live with. You know, it's difficult. And you're bloated as well. Your stomach is bloated. You actually look like you're pregnant because your ovaries are just bulging. You're just a hot mess, really.
That's one way of putting it. Okay. Give me an example of one of your hardest days in this whole process.
So there was a few. So I should say when you inject yourself after that process, they do a retrieval, so they take eggs out,
okay,
and they mix them with the sperm and they produce embryos. And so I suppose at the beginning of this process, the first IVF that we did, probably the hardest. One of the hardest, looking back, one of the hardest periods for me was when that first IVF didn't work. And I suppose, you know, you can become really, when you look back, I was so naive, but I had so much hope And I think that, you know, women doing this, and you're spending so much money. It's such a financial burden. You spend so much money, and then you go through all of these injections, and you're taking all these hormones, and it takes so long. And then you eventually get to a point where you're taking a test, or you know, my first time, I didn't even get to take the test. My period just arrived like nothing had happened. Mm-hmm. Like, we hadn't spent all this money. Like, I hadn't taken all these injections. And it was, I was absolutely heartbroken the first time it didn't work.
Yeah, I can imagine. Because you felt, well, that didn't work, the one way we were trying it. This one will, and now, therefore, there's a sort of not an arrogance, but there's a confidence and belief that this is the system.
Yeah, and there's a hope. Mm. Now, I feel like when you've had so much, you've been trying for so long that you're disappointed when you're not doing it yourself. So you think that when medical intervention takes place and science takes place, that, you know, this will work, like, this is it, you know. And then when it doesn't, it's just crushing. It's so disappointing and so hard, and a heartache.
How many times did you go through IVF?
So, and I suppose this is, you know, to some people, this number will be outrageous. And to some people, it will be, you know, other women will have gone through this. But we did 13 IVFs.
In how many clinics?
In 4.
Over how many years?
Over 6 years.
In how many countries?
In 3 countries.
Did you want to have a baby, Rachel? Is this...
I was on a mission, Brian. On a mission. I think how I felt about it was that there was a plan, you know, and there was, we were going from an IVF to an IVF, there was always a plan, you mm-hmm. know, so that kept me going. That kept me hopeful. You know, I do an IVF, it didn't work. And so you'd move on to the next plan. Okay, what's the next plan? What's our next journey? Like, what's our next road? You know,
And there are two things that are coming out at me with your story, Rachel, and I ask them both respectfully. One is, there's a lot of people will say they do IVF once, and they feel like they were beaten up around the place emotionally and physically. They might try it twice, and then they'll say, I can't afford to. We'll get that in a second, but I can't do it. You went 13 times. It wouldn't be recommended for everyone. I mean, there's a regulation issue, and there's a personal choice issue, whatever you want to call it. We don't need to get into the morality or the politics of it, other than to say your choice was to do this, and we'll get to that in just a second. But you put yourself through a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot. And I suppose I need to caveat it by saying some of those 13 times would have been when we started the process and maybe I didn't produce enough eggs and I didn't produce, or I overproduced eggs and we didn't go through the full process. Mm-hmm. So some of it was that, but the majority of those goes were full IVFs. And yeah, that's a lot. It is a lot.
Yeah.
But I suppose it was over a period of 6 years. So...
Let me ask you the vulgar question about cost. That's a lot of countries, a lot of travel. That's a lot of the IVF doesn't come cheap. How was that for you?
Yeah, it was difficult. Like, it's very difficult. We got assistance from a family member who helped us out, and I understand that we're very lucky. The financial burden of this is huge. And if there's women going through it at the moment, it's really, really expensive. And when it doesn't work, you've got absolutely nothing to show for it. You know, like, as my dad always says, it's like throwing money over a half door. You know, like, that's what it is, because you've nothing to show for it. So the financial element of it is huge, huge.
I want you to take us to a place called Wild and Green in a little place called Milltown, which is in Dublin. And Wild and Green is a delicatessen sort of coffee shop.
Yeah.
Okay. And there's a bathroom there, a toilet, a bathroom. Take us into that bathroom and give us a time and a place, a time and a date, if you could.
Yeah. So that was July 2014.
14. How old were you?
I was 41.
And you're sitting in the toilet of this restaurant.
And I'm sitting in the toilet of this restaurant, and I took a pregnancy test, and I got back into my car, and I looked at it, and there was a little faint pink second line.
Now, before we get to that beautiful potential story, why were you in the bathroom of this deli restaurant?
I don't know what brought me to that. I used to go there all the time to get my lunch.
Okay.
And it also the synchronicity of it is I used to go to school there. That used to be St. Anne's in Millstead, and I used to go to school there. And
was there a chemist nearby by any chance?
Yeah, there is a chemist nearby.
Okay. You used the beautiful word synchronicity there, Rachel. Yeah, this is all coming together like a good plan on the A-team. Okay. So let's bring you back into the car now. You're looking at the pregnancy test.
Yeah.
What are you thinking?
Well, I suppose, Ryan, we've been here before, you know.
Yeah.
And so at that point I was probably less naive, and I was wiser about the situation and wiser about the process. And so there was a glimmer of hope, but there was also peppered with reality, and that this could easily be taken away. So, you know, there was that.
And who emerged into the world ultimately?
So Eve Lily Curtin emerged into the world on the 31st of March 2015.
I feel relieved myself. Honest to God, I should feel a burden has been lifted from my shoulders. I mean, you know, I say that in jest, but I mean that is extraordinary. So Eve arrived then, a little dote of a girl.
Yes, Eve arrived, and that was 2015, and then we said we always wanted. I would have loved to have had a sibling.
Okay.
So we went again, and we had another miscarriage, and then on the 28th of July 2017,
now,
for a little.
Yes. Where did you discover the second one, that you were pregnant with your second and third?
Back down in good old Wild and Green again.
Were you actually in the bathroom with your pregnancy test?
Yes.
Why?
Because it had just brought us luck in 2014.
Your lucky toilet. It was your lucky toilet.
My lucky toilet. It's glamour. It's glamour to the max.
Oh, Lordy. Okay, so Aaron was born in
28th July 2017.
Congratulations. So you have two girls.
Yes, two gorgeous girls. Yeah.
The question I was going to ask was it worth it? But I think that's a ridiculous question, because clearly it was. The next question was it easy?
No. So, Ryan, I suppose with all of that, all of those miscarriages, all of those failed IVFs, that all comes at a cost. And I suppose every failed IVF and every miscarriage was, I didn't deal with it at the time. I pushed it all down, just, you know, got on with it, kind of would have had a failed IVF or a miscarriage, and just would have gone on to the next one. So what's the plan? You know, move on to the next thing. And I never processed anything. I never dealt with anything. And I had friends who supported me. I had my friend in America who had gone through IVF, and she was a massive support. I had another friend who was the initiator of me writing a blog. Her name is Deborah Brock from NUA Fertility. And Deborah persuaded me to write a blog about my experiences, because she's trying to help other women going through this. And so I did, and the reason I wrote that is because I did want to help other women, because I didn't deal with what I was going through at the time at all. I didn't process it. I just kept on pushing things down and moving on.
Mm-hmm.
And so after my two girls were born, it all hit me like a train. I like crashed into a wall after Erin was born, and it all, because that stuff just follows you. You know, it's grief and it's trauma, and if you don't deal with that, it comes and it finds you.
And how did you confront it?
Well, it confronted me, really. So I had to deal with it. And so I got help, Ryan.
Oh,
I just
good.
Talked to somebody and processed it. And I think Deborah asking me to write the blog just came at a really good time. I felt like there was enough time had elapsed, and I was able to look back objectively, and it wasn't raw anymore.
Good Lord. A Cork man, self-described, says, it never worked for us, the IVF. It is emotional savagery. That's quite an expression. He said, we adopted a child, thank God, and they're happy, which is good. Another says, it took us 12 years in total, but we're very proud parents to two wonderful children through adoption. IVF isn't the only option for couples. And it's brave of Rachel to share her story. It's great to hear IVF being spoken about. I'm also 41 and my husband and I were at the start of our IVF experience after two miscarriages. But your Rachel's story this morning gives me hope. So thank you for that. The National Infertility Support and Information Group is in Cork if people need to feel that they'd like to talk to somebody about this, they can. Rachel, I thank you so much for telling us your story this morning. You told it so well, so clearly, and without confusing me at all. I feel very enlightened on the subject, and thank you for that. And congratulations to you and your partner and the two girls.
Thank you, Ryan.
Yeah, I wish you every happiness. I mean that.
Thanks a lot, Ryan.
Okay. See you soon, Rachel. Thanks for your
Take
time
care.
Today. Thank
Bye
you, Rachel. Bye. Rachel Scanlon joining us live on the programme this morning to talk about her extraordinary experience. At the text 51551, you can email ryan@rte.ie. It's 11 minutes to 10. Paddy Burke, a very good morning to you.
Hi, Ryan. How are you?
Are you well this morning?
I'm good. I'm goodish.
You're okay-ish.
Good.
Is the rain falling or the sun shining, wherever you are?
The rain is falling. I was out for a run. I'm just back, so I'm feeling good.
And where are you in the world, may I ask?
I live in Baldoyle.
In Baldoyle. And you took to email to say, all right, I'm going to write to this fella to say, I've got to get some stuff off my chest, or at least you want to tell me something. So you very kindly agreed to talk to us about it this morning. You've worked with the Irish Wheelchair Association for a long time now.
I'm with them for 30 years now, Ryan.
Yeah.
And the reason why I wrote the email was I wanted to thank people for what they did for me. Just to give you a little story, my son was diagnosed with cancer on the 13th of December.
Just last year?
Just last year,
okay.
Yeah. Just before his third birthday. I met you up in St. John's Ward.
Oh, right, Paddy, I didn't know that.
In January.
Okay.
I didn't get to talk to you. I got a stand beside, but that was good enough for me.
No. let's just put that in. So St. John's Ward, just for people to know, is the cancer unit up in.
It's the cancer unit, up in Cormorant Hospital.
And
yeah.
You were there in January, so you weren't long in this world of cancer and children. Okay.
No. He was diagnosed on the 13th. He got leukemia. And we were basically in lockdown since the 13th of December.
Yeah.
We had decided we had to close that door. We'd no other children. We were lucky.
Okay.
Also, as well, my job allowed me to work from home. So it wasn't before COVID. We would have been worrying about the common cold. We would have been worrying about a flu because, he'd absolutely no defense system whatsoever.
What's his name?
His name is Patrick, like his dad.
Paddy Jr., Patrick Jr.
Patrick Jr., yeah.
Three years old.
So
what is that like, if I may ask you, from one dad to another, to be told that news in the hospital one morning when you go in just to see what the hell's going on?
Well, I knew when four people walked into the room,
yeah.
I knew it wasn't good.
Mm.
And then he told he had cancer. And I was actually playing with him on the floor with a little toy and just a shock. Now, what I did, I actually walked out to the doctor and I asked the doctor, I said, listen, you need to tell me, what's the chances? I said, I need to know. And fair play to her. She said, they're very, very good. She said, the treatment is going to be very harsh. It's not nice treatment. But the success rate is absolutely very, very high. And she was right in both ways. The success rate was very high. The treatment has been very, very tough on the poor child.
It's tough on an adult.
Oh yeah, and the child is just, I'm not joking around, from head to toe, yeah. from his poor bottom breaking down because of the stuff going through him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you get him home and you take the temperature. If the temperature goes to 38, you're back in. Now normally with a child, a bit of Calpol may do, but no. 38, you're saying something is brewing. He doesn't have the fences to fight this. He needs to go back in. So we could have been here at 11 o'clock and he'd be only out of the hospital. Could be here at 11 o'clock on Friday evening, back in again. And he hated it.
Yeah.
Oh, he screamed and he screamed and he screamed. So you're talking about earlier on about the Colosseum and the noise and the blood and the screams and the sweat. there would have been days up in the hospital where I felt that, you know.
I wasn't thinking of you when I was talking about Gladiator, Paddy, but now I realise I'm talking to the proper, the Irish Maximus over here.
Absolutely, Russell Crowe, move over.
Beat it, Russell, there's a new kid in town.
Absolutely. But listen, really what I wanted to say was just the amazing people out there that actually helped us was just incredible. Just the country we live in, Ryan. Now, I know there's people out there like me waiting on the procedures, and I don't want to talk about them. I just want to talk about this case. From the day we went in, the treatment has been absolutely nothing but superb.
Okay.
And you know what? All free.
Yeah.
We could not afford to pay for that. You know, we're on an international group of people with children with cancer, and in some countries, they have to pay for every bit of treatment, and they will not get their second treatment until they pay for their first.
No, it's desperate. Yeah.
You know, and a woman had to sell in her house, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just small little things, Ryan. One time I came home after a very, very bad day in the hospital, and COVID was around. So basically, we had lost all contact with all the other parents who we used to meet. And I come home one day, and there was a bottle of milk and a loaf of bread on my door. And I just cried. It's just that little small gesture really had to say, and it lifted me. My family, my friends, my job have seen us through this. Now today, I mean, he's bouncing around
good,
like an enormous 3-year-old.
Good, thank God. Yeah, okay, good. Is he, are there prognosis?
Yeah, it is good. Still, basically what happens is, like, I mean, you get treated for 3 years. So what they do is, like, I mean, you still have cancer, and they will treat you for cancer. And they'll do that for 3 years, you know.
Okay.
So, it's been a road, but there's been some amazing people. Amazing people have helped us. And I just want to thank everybody. Even Michael comes on a Monday on his bike from the blood bank. We take the blood on a Monday. Michael comes at 5 o'clock. He lets Patrick on the motorbike, switches on the lights. And Patrick can't wait for Michael to come along to bring the blood off. So, you know, it's everything. So it's really been, it's been a journey, but I couldn't have done it without the people that I know and the people I don't know as well.
You know that expression, it takes a village, you know, it really does.
It really does, like, you know, and like in my job as well, I just wanted to mention two things on this as well.
Yeah, sure.
Like, I mean, just to, there's hidden people out there, Ryan, like, you know, before COVID, during COVID, and I'm sure after COVID, who carers in this country from the Irish Wheelchair Association and others who are up every morning going into people's houses, you know, just to give them the basic right to get out of bed. You know, it's just this, the loneliness here now has, I've worked for 30 years with the wheelchair, and I thought I knew what loneliness was until this came along to me now. And there's so many people out there lonely. And if anybody that's listening, if you can do anything at all, whether it's a bit of bread, whether it's a magazine, anything at all to a neighbour, you may not think you're doing anything good, you know, but it does really, really help.
Paddy, we're going to send you over a very silly thing, but something that I hope Patrick will enjoy, which is, because you can't buy them in the shops this year, but it's a set of Toy Show pajamas from me to him from Penny's, just to wish him a happy Christmas from the Toy Man with love.
He'd absolutely love it, Ryan.
He would absolutely love it.
He really, really would. Like, you know, and listen, Ryan, it's great. Like, and thanks a million for having us on.
No, it's a pleasure. Wish you well.
And as I say, it's not all, like, for me, it's not all doom and gloom. Like, you know, I look at my fridge, you know, I have food, I have heat, I have a roof over my head, and I have a healthy son. I couldn't wish for anything more.
You got the attitude right. Paddy, happy Christmas to you and Patrick and your family. Wishing you every happiness.
No problem, Ryan. And listen, thanks a million for the chance. Just to tell people thank you.
It's a lovely thing to do. Thank you. And all the best for now. Thank you, Pat. That's Paddy Burke joining us there. And I remember being there, and the family said the same thing. Said, if you could cut the grass first, don't come up to us on the door with the head tilt going, how are you? Just cut the grass. Just go to the shop. Just buy the milk. And that's where the help lies. But that's gratitude. It's a lovely attitude. So that was lovely. Appreciate that from Paddy. Nice one. Let me go to beautiful Roundstone in Connemara in glorious Galway. Ciara King, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
I'm very happy to see you, but to talk to you this morning. I don't know what class of view you have from where you are, but can you give me a sense of the place this morning? Make me envious and jealous.
It is very Paul Henry-esque. Oh. There's so many greys in the sky. And there's some dying winter greens on the trees, but there's also gorgeous lights up all along the pier because there's a music show been filmed in the village this week, believe it or believe it not.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll get there soon, I hope.
And can I just say before we start,
yes.
I want to apologise because I feel I've learned an awful lot about myself in the last 3 months and I feel like I've been trolling you and I haven't been that nice to you.
Yeah.
And then you've been very kindly have me on your show. So I want to say that I'm actually sorry about sending you all those gorgeous photos of the landscape of Connemara.
You, on occasion, these pictures come through and I think the vomit emoji has been used quite a lot by way of how sick I am at and how much I miss the place. So
and
thank
you. I don't even know why I was doing it.
I think it was cruelty.
And then it was someone that was like, that's actually really mean you were in Dublin for a majority of the pandemic, you know how it felt to be away from Connemara, so I want to apologise. So
I should have sent you back pictures of the Super Value car park and said this is what I'm looking at. You know, this is the cruelty, this is a bad trade off.
You never would have won, but anyway.
I wouldn't have, it's impossible to compete. Now for people who don't listen to 2FM, could you explain who you are and what you do there?
So my name is Ciara King and I'm a broadcaster on 2FM on a weekend show with Chris Green. So it's Chris and Ciara. We're on every Saturday and Sunday from 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock. And we've been doing the radio rounds now for about 11 years.
Yes.
You might know us from my radio as well. And then we came to 2FM about 6 or 7 years now.
And oh, congratulations on the recent figures where you got an enormous bounce. Well done.
We did indeed. And look, that's down to the listeners as well and
sure.
The pandemic and, you know, people looking for alternative ways to kind of get through the last couple of months. So yeah, and it was brilliant.
The sound quality is amazing here in the sense that you could be sitting across from me, but you're in an apartment, is that right?
No, I'm actually in my childhood bedroom.
Oh, sorry, you're broadcasting from your family home. I forgot that.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I am.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. And you've been doing that since...
I've been doing that since around the end of July, August. And I kind of made the decision then. I was like, 4 hours radio a week. What am I going to do here? Am I going to stay in Dublin during a pandemic living with 3 other people? Or can I take this opportunity to go home, start from the source again and just take a little bit of a break? The pandemic was, and I feel for people in Dublin City that are living in rented accommodation because it's pretty tough. It really, really is tough. And I was lucky. You know what I mean? I was lucky that RT allowed me to come down here. I stole a Thailand box that I'm never giving back. And it just kind of worked. It worked out for me that way. And a place came up and I've never lived on my own. I've never had my own place. So this was kind of the perfect opportunity to do it. You know, I do realize how lucky I am, by the way.
I know that. And you're unpleasant with it. Tell me about Children in Hospital Ireland and what they do and why we're, well, we will talk about why we're talking about that in a second, but tell me about them.
Well, children, when I first started in RTE, I wanted to kind of use my voice I wanted to loan my voice to a cause that I believed in and that meant something to me. So children, I reached out to a couple of people and Children in Hospital Ireland got back to me. And this is when I'd just come to RTE about 6 or 7 years ago. So I must have really liked them because I ended up doing a mini marathon for them.
Mm.
And I haven't done one since. they brought me out to Crumlin Hospital or Talla Hospital and they brought me into the playroom. And what they do is they're one of these organizations that they provide services, play services for children in hospitals. And they also provide valuable time for parents who are in with the children to grab a cup of tea, to grab a cup of coffee. They've got books, they've got toys. It's they do arts and crafts. They're in a couple of hospitals all over the country. And as anyone who has been in that situation, who has had sick children, who is a parent of a sick child, it's always nice to have a little haven in a hospital environment. And Children in Hospital, I met some of the volunteers as well. Oh my God, they're just salt of the earth people. They're so loving. And it's a charity that I'm very, very proud to have my name attached to.
It's a lovely thing. And they have the Cup of Kindness.
It's National Children's Day tomorrow. And so they're doing the Cup of Kindness. So they're basically looking for the price of a cup of coffee or a cookie, which is about €5. And they have various places where you can go on and donate that. So if you can give, I know that you know, so many people have been so good this year giving to different charities. You were just talking about St. Vincent de Paul there. Mm-hmm. And I know that not a lot of people have a lot this year, but if you can, if you've any coins at all, justgiving.com/campaign/cup of kindness and or else check out childrenhospital.ie.
I'm going to bring you somewhere difficult and you can stop me if it's getting too difficult. All right, Ciara? So
okay.
we'll tread carefully, but we'll go there together. And in some ways, I want to go to you watching the TV one Friday night not too many weeks ago when you saw the great Rob Kearney, Irish rugby player, mm-hmm. chatting away, and you thought, here we go, it'll be another interview about great success, about the Six Nations and the, you know, and all his wonderful achievements. I don't say that lightly, but
no,
but,
I know.
But
yeah.
his conversation moved, went somewhere completely unexpected.
It did, and I was sitting on my own, and I was having a cup of tea, and I was watching the Late Late Show, and Rob Kearney came on, and obviously I know his autobiography is coming out. I'm a huge fan of Rob Kearney. Mm-hmm. I'm a massive fan of the Irish rugby team. I'm going to have to say Connacht and Munster here before
obviously.
My mother and father kill me.
Yes.
Yeah, and then. I remember you talking to me, you said, you know, do you want to talk about this? And he talked about his brother who had passed away. And I was sitting on the couch and I was like, God, I didn't know that about Rob Kearney. And then he said that he didn't remember him. And I got really excited, and not for the normal reasons for seeing Rob Kearney on the TV. It was because Rob Kearney had, I had identified with Rob Kearney on a level that I hadn't identified with anyone else. I also had a brother who passed away that I don't remember. So for me, I actually texted a friend of Rob's, and this manic text message, been like, oh my God, will you please tell Rob that I said thank you so much. And I have never seen myself represented on the television before. In Rob Kearney. I know that
yes.
sounds really weird.
Well, it does. And just to remind people, so Rob's older brother, Ross, was killed by a lorry in mm-hmm. a desperate accident when Rob was, I think he was 6 years old at that time. Or no, the brother, Ross was 6 years old at the time, as far as I remember. I'm a bit hazy on the detail, but it was something that he was very articulate talking about the pain of that and then trying to remember the detail of that and trying
yeah.
to keep that his brother Ross alive in his heart, if you like. And that got you thinking about your brother Dara.
It did, because as I said, I've been a patron for Children in Hospital Ireland for the last 6 years, but I've never really talked about the fact of why I do this. And it is in memory of my brother Dara, but also I don't think I'd be doing the charity. I don't think I'd be giving my best to the charity if I didn't share this story. And mm-hmm. I was always going to share the story. I just didn't know when I was going to share the story. You know, myself and Chris, when we first started radio together, we made a pact that we'd never talk about anything private on air.
Okay.
And the two of us have kept that pact and that trust and that respect, which is great. I can't explain it. Maybe it's the year that was. Maybe it's that this is bigger than me. And maybe it's that the charities really need our help this year. That's why I've come on to talk about my brother Dara.
Well, let's talk about Dara then, and as much as you can. Tell me everything you can tell me about him.
Well, he was born in England, and he was 6 years older than me, and he developed leukemia when he was around five and a half, six mm-hmm. years of age. So then mum and dad had moved back to Connemara at that stage, because I was born in Ireland, and mum and dad said he was home within a week, and he had a really broad Connemara accent. And this is from, you know, spending time in London in the late 70s, hanging out with, you know, multi ethnicities, you know, across London City. And mum and dad had that life in the late 70s, very much based on Tottenham Court Road. So there's this image that I have of my brother who was born in England, and then this image of him coming home and having a Connemara accent and getting into fishing within a week, like.
Mm.
And then, of course, obviously developing, it was acute lymphatic leukemia.
Okay.
So then a lot of that was, he was obviously in and out of hospital. It didn't really last that long, you know, the whole process of him getting diagnosed to him actually passing away. So he spent, you know, some time in the regional hospital in Galway, Temple Street in Dublin, but he ended up in the Royal Marsden in the UK. Because that's the only hospital that would take him, actually.
Because of the time.
Yeah, seemingly it was very hard. It was very hard to get, if you're a child with cancer, to get into hospitals in England and Scotland and Ireland at the time. But the Royal Marsden took him in.
I can see why this story chimed, because like with Rob Kearney, Rob was two and a half. His brother was
yeah.
six. His brother Ross was six. Your Dara
yeah.
was seven. How old at that time?
I was two and a half.
Two and a half. He came to your cot when you were born.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what happened.
I think this was a couple of, this was, I was, mum had put me down to sleep, I think, and she had obviously gone up to wake me at some stage. And when she walked into the room, Dara had changed my nappy and he was feeding me, and he was like, yeah, she's fine, mum, I got her. You know, he was that kind of kid. And mum was telling me a funny story last night, actually, because mum said that I was the holy terror in the hospital. I was two and a half.
Yeah, I believe,
you know,
that,
she said,
yeah.
She said the doctors and the nurses still talk about me. But she told me, genuinely, Ryan, like seriously, okay, all these years later, and I'm like, I think I'm a lovely person. But no, he used to have this drip feed thing, and mum was telling me about it last night, and he used to put me up on the drip feed. It was like, went like a long pole and it searched into his arm, and he used to race up and down the the hospital ward. And that was something that I hadn't heard until last night, and I just thought, that's really funny.
And he was allowed to pick a name for you, which I think
history
could have been so different.
It could have been. That was my baby brother, because I double checked. He was a massive fan of the A-Team, and when my little brother Patrick was born, Patrick was six months.
Patrick had done that.
Yeah, he wanted to call Patrick either Mr. T, Hannibal or Murdoch, and he wasn't taking no for an answer, but my father, you know, pushed through for Patrick. So there you go. Could have been very different.
I think Hannibal cool King has a very good ring to it.
I'd love to have a younger brother called Mr. T. How awesome would that be?
Okay. With regard to Dara, he was 7 years old when he died, and I can't, you know, it's the great aberration for any parent, let alone sibling, to have to say goodbye to somebody so young and so beautiful. And your parents are obviously happy to talk about him now. And I wanted to say thank you to them for allowing you to come on and talk about your brother this morning. How has Dara's presence been felt in your life?
Oh, God.
Because you don't remember him.
No, I don't. So if I go right back, like I can, like I'm sitting in my childhood bedroom right now, you know, my single bed is still here. And I used to lie in bed at night as a little girl, and I used to will myself to have a memory. I used to be like, no, Kira, you definitely do. And then I think I got to my teenage years and I read an article about repression, and I was like, I've repressed my memories. So they're there, and you know what I mean? And then I got to my 20s and I was like, man, I don't remember him. So there's things that I have done in my life to make sure that he is very much alive for me, if that makes sense.
Like what?
And I have to say, credit to my mum and dad,
sure,
because we talk about him all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And I have to say, my mum's family and my dad's family, my cousins, the people of the village, they have kept his memory alive for me. And they've allowed me to, like, create this little tapestry of what I think his life was while he was here with us. Do you know that sort of way? The London life and the Roundstone life. And I love that people share stories, and I really appreciate it. And when you're least expecting it, someone will share a story with you.
It's amazing, you know? Yeah. When something I've learned from sitting in this chair is that people who've suffered a bereavement love to talk about the person they've lost. People who approach people who've suffered a bereavement don't know where to look.
Yeah, yeah.
And the truth is that the bereaved would love if that person who was awkward said, do you know what I loved about Dara? And you go, no, tell me everything, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a strange one.
It is, because I've kind of felt a kind of guilt, you know, when I was younger. You know, people say to me, oh, do you have any brothers and sisters? And I'd always say, yes, I have a younger brother called Patrick and I have an older brother called Dara, but he died. And then people would just get really, really awkward. But then on the flip side of that, when I got asked if I have any siblings, I'm like, yeah, no, I've got a little brother called Patrick. And then in my head, it was like, say Dara. So it's this weird guilt.
I wonder why you were so desperate to find a memory in the bank. To what effect, I wonder? What was it, just a natural desire to remember somebody you should be thinking of?
Well, he was my older brother.
Yeah,
100%. And, you know, I've had friends who've lost their siblings at later, you know, times in their life, and they've come up to me and they're like, here, you get it. And I'm like, I do, but I really don't. And I often wonder, would I have been better off remembering him or not remembering him?
You know the answer to that now, of course.
Yeah, I know.
You know the answer to that now. But it's true. It is true.
Yeah.
But it's a fair... It's a fair dilemma, you know. It's natural, I think, to think that way. Tell me why Barry McGuigan was important in your family in the 80s.
Oh, God. So Barry McGuigan is a superstar in our house. So Barry, he was fighting for, was it the Featherweight Championship? Dara was a massive fan. Like, he had Barry McGuigan jumpers and T-shirts and somebody got in contact with Barry McGuigan's dad through some dance scene and got on to Barry to record Dara a tape when Dara was sick. And Barry very graciously recorded this gorgeous tape to Dara, you know, telling him to keep on fighting. And that if he was ever up our way, that Dara was to pop in to make sure. So then Dara wrote him a letter being like, well, if you're ever down around Stone, you know, you can always pop in to me, my sister Kira, and my brother Patrick. And we absolutely loved Barry McGuigan. And the night that Barry won that huge title, Dara was actually really, really sick. But he came, but he was over in London at the time. I think he was in Mum's sister's house. And he got phone calls from Ireland when Barry McGuigan won, you know. And the next day he went back to the hospital and they all lined the ward and they clapped. Yeah.
That's a sweet thing.
Yeah. And it's even weirder. My cousin Shane was back for a rugby match a couple of years back. And as we do when cousins get together, they always bring up Dara. And I really have to thank them for that. And we were chatting about Barry McGuigan and what Barry McGuigan did. And he said, you know, Kira, you should email him. And I was like, yeah, you know, I've often thought about it, whatever. And then a couple of days later, I was still doing nights on 2FM and I was kind of ferreting around the desk like an urban raccoon, probably trying to steal pens or something. And this piece of paper fell off a desk and I just picked it up and it had Barry McGuigan and his phone number written on it. And I was like, oh, my God, if this isn't a sign. But I wasn't going to ring Barry McGuigan and be like, hello, do I have a story for you? So I got on to a really good friend of mine who works in sport and he sent me Barry McGuigan's email. And I decided on the 28th of February, which is the day that my brother passed away, to send Barry McGuigan an email and just tell him what he did for our family and how we feel about him and all the rest. And I realised that the 28th of February is not only the day that Dara passed away, but it's also Barry McGuigan's birthday.
Oh, Lordy.
Yeah. So I didn't get an answer for a while. And I didn't even mind whether I got an answer or not. I just wanted to say what he had done for our family, you know. And he emailed back. It had gone into a spam account, which I was really annoyed about because I used my RTE address and everything to make sure that he'd see it. But he emailed back a couple of weeks later and he wrote me the most beautiful email. And he said that he'd keep Dara in his thoughts, you know, on his birthday. And then obviously, was it last year, his beautiful daughter passed away. Oh, and, no. You know, I know this is going to sound strange, but we felt it in our house.
I believe that.
You know,
I believe that.
We did.
God, what a desperate story for Barry as well. And just so awful. But I can understand why you felt it and why your folks particularly felt it, because he was part of this story in many ways.
Yeah.
What do you think, Kira, how do you think that Dara's premature departure from the world affected you in your 20s and beyond?
It's definitely, you know, a couple of years back, I was going through a significant breakup. I wasn't dealing with it as I should have been dealing with it, as in I wasn't getting better and I was actually completely losing my mind. And I was like, wait a second, there's something deeper going on here. And obviously, I'd never felt this way in my life before. So I went to therapy for it. And through process of elimination, you know, the lady therapist said to me, she said, you have to grieve for your brother. And it took me about 30 years to realize that I had to grieve for my brother, because for me, it was my mum and dad's grief. It was, you know, my family's grief. Imagine, it took me 30 years to realize that I had to grieve for my brother. So that in itself, and then, you know what, that just opened a whole, you know, can of worms. And it's the best thing that I ever did. And it turns out that the reason that breakup affected me so desperately was because, you know, there was abandonment issues there. And I remember being like, what? I do not have abandonment. Tony Soprano has abandonment issues. I don't have abandonment issues. But it, of course, it makes sense. And I think that we'd all be really foolish to think that certain things that happened in our childhood aren't going to manifest in some way in our adulthood, no matter what that situation was. And that just happened to be mine, you know. And I think you go two ways with that as well.
Yeah, go on.
And you know, you learn that, and I've learned so much, and it's the best thing that I've ever done. And Dara sits comfortably on my shoulder now, if that makes sense.
It does.
And but for me, it's been a it's one of the best things I've ever done, because I've discovered that I know why I am the way I am. I know why I have done all these things. I know the reason that I wasn't supposed to be the firstborn. I was supposed to be the awkward middle child. And then I got propelled into what I gave myself an awful lot of responsibility that I took on, which was the narrative that I fed myself, not my parents, not anybody else. It was me. And I've just realized how hard I've been on myself for about 30 years. But yeah, so it's been interesting. And I think you can go two ways when something like that happens. You can cling on to a relationship and you can put your claws in, or you can go, do you know what? I'm just going to withdraw because I can't deal with that. And I think that's probably what I've done for the last couple of years. And that is all connected to my childhood. But again, it's a learning process. And I'm at least at this stage.
It's remarkable, you know? Isn't it? How the passage of time. Ryan and Kira says, Anne, I'm listening to both of you, and I'm reminded of the Seamus Heaney poem Midterm Break. I'm sure you're well familiar with it, which tells the story of his 4-year-old brother who was killed by a car. Seamus was 14 at the time. It's extraordinary how conversations like this bring people into the fold. Alison says, my brother died of leukemia when he was 5, I was 11. I should have loads of memories, but my memories start when he was diagnosed and all his sickness over the following year. I remember the funeral vividly, even small details, but absolutely nothing about the years when he was well. 30 years later, I still feel so sad about this. You were concerned about coming on to talk about something so personal, but when you hear responses like that, it must allow you the freedom to understand how important it is to talk.
Yeah, and look, I'm a bit of a cynic because I work in the media myself. And, you know, there's been times where I'm like, oh, could everyone just stop sharing their stories, you know? And now, you know, after, you know, a couple of years, I see the benefit. I see the benefit my certain friends get when they read something that resonates with them. And I know how I felt when Rob Kearney said that on the television that night. And I know that might sound strange to so many people. But to me, it was a revelation. Like, it was just, I couldn't believe it. You know, I wanted to do crazy things. I wanted to, like, I text my friend and I was like, would it be weird if I rang him? Would it be, you know, just to, and then it was like, okay, I need to relax. Because sometimes I can be a little bit when it comes to, you know, when it comes to people share. Because I think that all human beings are just looking to be understood. And, you know, when you've been through something so specific, let's say, you really want to connect on a level where someone can kind of get it, you know?
Yeah, of course. Anyway. No, it makes perfect sense. And sometimes there are clubs no one wants to be members of, but you do need to meet fellow members to stay sane. Kira, it's been good to talk to you this morning.
Thank you.
How are you feeling?
So much.
Are you okay?
I'm good. I didn't get a wink of sleep.
No, I'm not surprised. No, I know you were. This wasn't an easy thing for you or your family to do. But I think I can see from the text, it's already made a difference to a lot of people this morning. So thank you for that. I mean,
look, thank your team. You know, I love you guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Likewise, Len. Get yourself a cup of something and go for a lovely walk along where Dog's Bay maybe, and don't send me a picture, and I wish you I'll catch up with you in due course, but mind yourself, Kira. Thank you to you and your family. See you soon.
Thanks, Ryan. Bye.
Thank you. Kira King joining us from her childhood bedroom in the Roundstone in Connemara this morning. And you know, tomorrow, as she was saying, marks World Children's Day, and what an important day in this crazy time. It's the annual fundraising day, the Cup of Kindness for Children in Hospital Ireland, and people can donate the price of a cup of tea and a biscuit to justgiving.com, and you can also go to childreninhospital.ie for details on information and how to donate. But like I said to Kira a second ago, it's an enormous response to her conversation, and you know, from people like Kate, who says, I worry about my daughter who has become the oldest due to her brother's accident and death. This is a lovely and heartbreaking conversation. Yeah, sometimes heartbreaking conversations are required. And that's why we're so grateful to Kira King for doing that for us this morning.